from ACV Radio Mainstream. Welcome to Tuesday Topics. Over the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to persons who are blind or visually impaired.
I go out walking after midnight, out in the moonlight, just like we used to do. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you.
Now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
I am Paul Edwards in Miami, Florida. Good evening and welcome to Tuesday Topics. Let me begin as usual by expressing debts I can't really repay to our producer and this evening also our participant, Brian Charlson. And I would also like to thank our editor-recorder, Steve Bauer, and, of course, George Byes from Talking Communities, whose software makes this program possible. This evening, we're actually talking about orientation and mobility, and this topic may seem to many of you a somewhat arcane one, but I think by the time we're finished, you will have a better idea of why we've chosen to talk about it. There are a number of things in the field of orientation and mobility that are changing, some of them for the good and some of them perhaps for the bad. And what we hope to do is to get people thinking about it and perhaps as well to begin to look at some options that might be out there for making things a little bit better. So in order to discuss some of these issues, we have with us our illustrious producer, who happened to be present at a panel that occurred at the Josephine L. Taylor Leadership Training Institute, an annual event sponsored by the American Foundation for the Blind, which this year, I think, was held in San Francisco. And that event this year focused a lot on technology and had a panel that related to orientation and mobility. And Brian, perhaps you could begin by telling us a little bit about who the participants on that panel were, should you happen to remember. And also, if you could, tell us a little bit about what attracted your attention about the panel.
The Josephine L. Taylor Leadership Institute has been going on for a number of decades now. And as a former member of the AFB, American Foundation for the Blind Board of Trustees, it's been my pleasure to attend a number of them. This particular one I attended not as a trustee, although I'm a trustee emeritus of AFB, but as a director of a technology program at the Carroll Center for the Blind outside of Boston, and as a good friend of one of the people who was going to be receiving the Miguel Award, which is the highest award given by AFB each year. That went to our friend and past ACB president, Leroy Saunders. But in looking over the program, each year JLTLI picks a particular topic, and this year it was technology, so I could justify going on that grounds alone. And while it truly was a who's who in the field of access technology for the blind and visually impaired in terms of the entire program, one of the breakout sessions I was pleased to participate in was called Getting Around Town. It was moderated by Gil Johnson of AFB, who, by the way, will be retiring in about 1 month's time, and had a number of very qualified people speaking on it. And what I found enjoyable about it is they weren't all coming from the issue of orientation and mobility from the same side of the fence, so to speak. Those individuals included Anita Arendt, who is the head of the San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind. Her area of expertise, as far as this panel was concerned, was on advocacy to put in detectable warnings at curb cuts and accessible pedestrian signals, as well as talking signs throughout the city of San Francisco.
So did Anita have a lot to say about kind of the macro issue? Because we've had talking signs for quite a while, but even though the company kept saying they were going to take off, we really hadn't seen that burst of effort. But I guess San Francisco is the city that has done the most, and I think they not only were able to deal with some talking signs in some areas, but were also able to get some accessible pedestrian signals installed in the San Francisco area as well.
In fact, it's kind of a combination of the two, as I understand it anyway. They've incorporated into the accessible pedestrian signals many of the aspects of a talking sign scenario. That is, if you hold the button down, you learn about the intersection, both the name of the two streets that intersect or more, but also any peculiarities about the particular crossing you're at, such as has a median strip or angled sharply to the left or those kinds of things that you wouldn't necessarily know about that street crossing unless you were a frequent person passing through there. Again, another ACB friend, that is Margie Donovan, mentioned that on one occasion during bad weather, she actually used one of these signs by simply pressing in and holding down the button to identify where she was, since she had taken a very bad crossing in a bad windy day and wasn't at all sure which intersection she was at when it was all said and done. And they've been able to get not just one or two, which most of us have been able to accomplish in our communities, but rather a commitment from the city for more than 100 such street crossings.
Yeah, it actually is pretty amazing to think of advocates being able to accomplish that much. Do you know, or did she talk about the kind of advocacy efforts that it took to make that happen? I mean, did she just go and ask them and they said, okay?
By no means was it a quick fix. It did take quite a bit of time. It took community involvement, and it also took a couple of lawyers, particularly our friends in ACB, Lainey Feingold and Linda, whose last name I always butcher, Paul, so I hope that you can straighten me out on that. These are the legal beagles who have helped us out in achieving access to ATMs and currently involved with us in gaining access to point-of-sale machines. It was through that type of arbitration that the city settled with those who had filed complaints, and this was the end result.
Yes, that's Linda Dardarian.
Yeah, thank you, Linda Dardarian. Yeah, I actually did know that, but do appreciate the input. The intriguing thing, of course, is that since that was the approach that was taken, and it's an approach that's come to be known as structured negotiation, since that was the approach that was taken, it suggests that there's perhaps hope for applying the same principles in other communities. Because that approach suggests to a city that they have some legal responsibilities, and why not do the right thing rather than face a long and protracted battle with kind of high legal costs and attorney's fees and a whole bunch of other stuff. Instead, let's do the right thing. We'll help you to make certain that you do it and tell you exactly what you need to do in order to come into compliance with the law. So it has been an extremely successful approach to getting communities to obey the law at the same time as giving them opportunities to acquire a lot of credit for doing the right thing. So Lainey Feingold and Linda Dardarian are certainly people who, in my view, have revolutionized the way all of us look at ADA litigation. So I think what happened there was pretty exciting. Tell us about some of the other panelists, Brian.
We also had Lucas Frank from the CNI there. His background is kind of unique in that he was a CNI instructor prior to getting his degree in orientation and mobility, and later joined the efforts of BZ Benson in doing research on pedestrian safety-related issues. So again, things like detectable warnings, accessible pedestrian signals. He was there to talk about, if you will, the difficult times ahead. Specifically, he was concerned about roundabouts. and came prepared with raised line drawings of what was meant by a roundabout. Now, I've heard lots of descriptions of what these are, thought that I understood, and am now thoroughly convinced I had misunderstood for all this time. The best way to describe a roundabout is a intersection of four, five, or six streets coming to a single point. They place an island in the middle of the intersection in such a way that for any car to pass through the intersection, the car must swerve to its right in order to go straight across an intersection, going around that center island. A roundabout also has each one of the two-way streets entering the roundabout divided by a delta island, delta meaning kind of a triangular shaped island that splits the traffic so that all of the traffic entering the roundabout must be forced to the right to go around the roundabout, always to the right, while all the traffic coming off comes off on the left. The end result is you have a lot of crossings to take in order to simply cross two streets. You're actually making four crossings, and the traffic coming toward you is not coming straight across in front of you, but rather is turning to come in front of you as you're attempting to cross that intersection. This creates a whole series of problems for those who are blind or visually impaired, whether using cane or dog to cross the intersection. And apparently the powers that be and the Federal Transportation Agency have established standards that say all roundabouts with a single lane, that means one lane going in the same direction, single lane, would have to have traffic signals that would be accessible to us. But it does not say that anything that has two lanes, pardon me, it's the other way around. Anything with two lanes gets traffic signals. Anything with a single lane does not. And, of course, there's going to be a lot more small intersections than are going to be very large intersections. So we still have some efforts ahead of us there to make sure that those roundabouts can be traversed by a cane or guide dog using blind or visually impaired person.
Well, I'm forced to say that I didn't understand what a roundabout is either. This is a gratuitous question, Brian, and you may not know the answer, but why do cities like roundabouts? What are the things that make them so attractive to traffic engineers that they are springing up like weeds everywhere?
Actually, for a rare occasion, I actually know the answer to that question, at least that's been expressed by the engineers themselves. And that is, it's all an attempt to slow traffic down as it passes through an intersection to control traffic flow. There's no way that a car can go into one of these roundabouts without slowing down to take the curve around the central island. There's no way they can do anything but slow down as they're approaching leaving the roundabout as well because of the angles they're having to turn to enter and exit the roundabout. They have a number of statistics that prove that accidents that happen in a roundabout generate less problems for the drivers of the vehicles and less problems because they're lower impact crashes than would otherwise be expected. And it's also statistically apparently proven that the nature of pedestrian accidents in roundabouts are also less often fatal as a result of slowed down traffic. We laughingly said, so, now things will be much better because of roundabouts. Instead of dying outright, we'll simply be crippled for life. Because certainly we all, as blind persons, have some questions about the skills that will be required to go through a roundabout rather than having to, if you'll pardon the expression, go roundabout to go around them.
Hi, this is Bob Hache. I have heard it said, I have not heard any qualified person tell me this to my face, but that roundabouts cause more traffic to flow more efficiently through one of these things rather than a typical plus sign intersection because the cars don't have to spend nearly as much time stopped at a light. And that's because they're supposed to only stop when a pedestrian makes eye contact with them, which means that if we don't get some sort of accessible pedestrian signals where we can push a button, we're stuck.
There are certainly roundabouts that are of the nature you described. But again, the number one issue for these roundabouts is to slow down traffic so that they're, when there are accidents, they're at lower speed and therefore reduce the cost to society in general.
And to dot I's and cross squiggles, as it were, the primary issue in terms of orientation and mobility is because everything is built at angles and essentially fairly complex angles at that, it is extremely difficult for anyone who is attempting to cross without the aid of vision to do so because a straight line is one of the things that is absent from most roundabouts, and it's necessary to actually change direction a couple of times in order to get from side A to side B, far less getting from side A to side C. Would that be correct, Mr. Ryan?
Indeed it is. And again, another value, not just for accessible pedestrian signals, meaning they indicate when it's safe to cross, so to speak, but also the value of the locator tones at the push buttons so that you can have a better idea as to what the straight across is going to be, using them as wayfinders as much as indicators of when to go and when to stop.
So what are we to do about roundabouts? I mean, there have been a number of us who in community after community have gone before traffic engineers and suggested that roundabouts are not nice and that they don't make things friendly for pedestrians in general, and that for blind people they're sheer hell. And essentially the traffic engineers look at us and they suggest, well, that's the price of progress, son. You know, roundabouts are very important in terms of assuring effective and appropriate traffic flow, and the needs of the many certainly outrank the concerns of the few. What are we to do?
Well, at this point, I think that there are two things that we can do. One is to advocate, as we do through our organization, for standards when building roundabouts that requires the installation of accessible pedestrian signals. Two, that when we go to speak in our communities about them, that we, to some degree, acknowledge the validity of their argument for their creation. That is, we all would like to see fewer fatalities as a result of auto accidents, lower damage in those accidents to help keep down the cost of insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So in the same way, we probably have to just give up when it comes to the issue of right on red. We probably have to find a way to live with this particular set of circumstances rather than to fight them outright. I would argue that in a case where they're being installed and there is no history of serious accidents at a given intersection, you have an argument against their installation. I also think that you have every right then to testify when they are being installed that the added expense of pedestrian signals in that roundabout are a reasonable expectation on the part of all pedestrians, not just those who are blind or visually impaired.
So we kind of have one plus and one minus, because clearly talking signs and accessible pedestrian signals are a plus in the 21st century orientation mobility environment, but clearly roundabouts are probably a minus. And I would suggest that another minus that's out there is the fact that two people who are fairly decent travelers, that is you and I, certainly had a less than acute understanding of what a roundabout in fact is and what its import is. I've certainly crossed at roundabout intersections before. I'm not sure I would have been quite so eager to do it had I understood how thoroughly complex these animals actually are. And clearly, for a lot of people who are relatively timid travelers, a roundabout may well deter them from actually traveling in areas where those things exist, and would either send them several blocks out of their way in order to find more traditional crossings, or simply make them use other ways of getting around in the area, which would be a shame. But I guess the other question that this brings us to is, are many or most of the people who have received orientation and mobility training at centers actually receiving training in how to negotiate roundabouts?
Yes, hi there. This is Darson. I'm in Washington State, but I've also lived in Oregon. I've lived in a large city where there are numerous roundabouts with traffic lights, and I'm blind, by the way, and use a white cane. I don't find them difficult. I find them easier than if there were no traffic lights there, for example. I now live in a small community that has one roundabout, and it's a place I'd lived earlier when there was no roundabout at a very busy, busy intersection, just a straight 90-degree, two streets crossing. Very difficult. And the roundabout, this one has no stoplights, makes it much, much easier to cross because I'm only crossing a lane of traffic going in one direction. And even in the larger city where they had the stoplights that weren't audible, it was easier because I had to listen for the traffic only coming at me in one direction. And so I like roundabouts myself.
One of the things that the educators in this area have pointed out to me, and I think that it's pretty accurate, is that a lot of us have been told that a given intersection is a roundabout only for an O&M instructor to show up and say, no, this is not what we mean by a roundabout. I live about a half mile from Watertown Square, which I will argue is one of the more difficult intersections to cross. It has one street coming in over a bridge straight into the square. It has a railless trolley that's an overhead wire type bus coming through the square. It has one major delta as kind of a bus turnaround area in the square. Two of the streets have median strips down them, requiring that you traverse half of the street, then wait and traverse the second half of the street at a different cycle of the light. And it has an island in the middle, just to make life interesting. And none of these streets approach at a 90-degree angle to any other street. And two of them have smaller streets entering the larger streets just about 50 feet from the square. So, as you can tell, it's a very, very complicated intersection. And I always thought of this as kind of a roundabout because it had an island in the middle. But the island in the middle never requires that the traffic change direction in order to pass, if you will, straight across the intersection. And that does change the flavor of the intersection and what works and what doesn't work. I know there are traffic situations out there where a roundabout would be a step in the right direction if you're crossing it in a particular way, if it's an intersection you cross frequently and therefore can understand the nature of the not straight across kind of an approach toward crossing intersections. You know, there's a lot of ifs in there. So I'm not one of those who condemns roundabout as a matter of course, but rather think that there are probably safe arrangements of them and less safe arrangements with them. And we have to be sure to be advocates out there to make sure that the ones that are installed are done properly.
This is Dave McElroy in Visalia, California. We do not have roundabouts here. I understand there is one in Fresno. I have not seen it, so I can't speak to it. What I can speak to is what I have heard about roundabouts. And this is outside the blindness community. As an addendum to what Brian has been saying, I have heard that the primary reason for roundabouts is not to slow traffic, but so that traffic doesn't have to stop as it's going from point A to point B, hence saving fuel. And this being the case, the roundabouts that we're discussing would have no traffic lights because a traffic light would make vehicles stop. And this is not the purpose of a roundabout, I'm told. This may be the issue, Brian, of why we can't get single lane roundabouts to be fitted out with traffic lights. I'm thinking that's probably the reason. That being the case, I'm willing to try it, but I do think we need to take a firmer stance as organizations. I think we need to step out and be counted, not to say no roundabouts, but what we must say is our safety must not be compromised. And I think that's what ACB needs to not be afraid to do.
This is Bob Hache. I think you've hit the nail on the head, and I think another element that we haven't mentioned yet is we need the accessible signals, but we also need some detectable warnings, particularly as a way of wayfinding where, as Brian says, we're doing things at odd angles. These detectable warnings, if done correctly, can be used as a way of helping us to navigate these things.
This is Gary Wood in Lansing, Michigan. We have what they call a traffic circle on Washington Avenue, downtown Lansing. And when I've heard about it, I've never crossed it. But they said that that wasn't a good thing because that's one of the busiest streets to cross. But I don't know, is there a difference between a roundabout and a traffic circle?
I can't say that I can describe the difference between the two, but I want to speak for a moment about some of the secondary issues that a roundabout deals with. You know, I've heard people argue in favor of roundabouts at two or three different public hearings, and they always seem to be able to march out whatever seems to be the reason of the day for doing them. If they think that the parties that are making the decision are more concerned about things like saving energy and reducing gas consumption, they'll march that out as a reason. If the issue has to do with making the community safer, and there's been complaints about speeding cars, they'll march out the it slows down traffic issue. You know, it goes round and round, if you'll pardon the expression, in dealing with what cause celebre they bring up in arguments in favor of their installation. I agree with Bob and with Dave that we have to be very consistent in ACB and simply say, in cases where a roundabout is determined to be the best way to deal with a given issue, that we are not against roundabouts because they're called roundabouts. We're against them if installed in a way that compromises our safety as well-trained, independent travelers, whether it be with a dog or a cane.
I'd actually like to jump backwards a second and ask Darson in Washington State a question about the roundabouts that he uses. One of the things that appears to be accurate about roundabouts is that cars don't pass straight in front of you. That is, they're coming at you at an angle. Is that an issue for you, Darson?
Actually, you get cars doing both at a roundabout. There is at this particular intersection, there's a circle in the middle which is planted, I guess, to look pretty or something. The cars always go counterclockwise. So if a person is going from headed north and wants to turn west, they have to go around three-quarters of the circle in order to go west. So when I'm crossing a street called High School Road, cars are always approaching me from my left. However, once I get across that first lane, then there's a space to wait there. There's a median, and it's accessible. There's no curb even, but there are little... no curbs you have to step up on. There are things on the side to guide the cane, so you know that's where you are. Then there will be a car approaching me on High School Road from the right, but it will have to turn right in order to go on around the circle. So I am going across two lanes of traffic, but only one at a time. That's the thing. And then one other thing I want to mention. I heard somebody ask about the difference between a traffic circle and a roundabout. What I've heard is a roundabout, as I heard somebody else say, is something, a place with no signals, and it's primarily done to help the traffic move smoothly. I'm not so sure I agree with that. A traffic circle, as I'd used a lot in Portland, Oregon, much bigger city and had lots of them, but they did have traffic lights. However, you still had the same idea of traffic only approaching you from one direction at a time.
Presumably, and this is just for a point of clarification, Darson, presumably as well, the other significant advantage is not only is traffic approaching you in one direction, but isn't going to do unpredictable things like turning right on red as they might on a regular intersection. Every car that's passing you as you're crossing is going to be doing exactly the same thing.
Absolutely, and that makes it easier for crossing. I do agree with the idea that they're not at a 90-degree angle, but in the case here, there are, I guess you'd call it like a curb. Not that you have to step off of, because it's also wheelchair accessible, but there's a thing, a curb along each side, which will help guide the cane.
Well, a blind gentleman here in Lansing that spoke up in public comment against this was saying how dangerous it would be for pedestrians on such a busy street. But also, one of the city council members says, they'll slow down for you and stuff like that. They'll stop for you.
Gosh, I'm not sure that'll happen. All right, Mr. Bryan. But I would still maintain that that's a minus. It's something that certainly is not or doesn't for me make or seem to make. Though Darson puts up a strong argument, I think, for it being doable. It still is a little tricky, at least from my perspective. So were there other panelists in this group, Mr. Bryan?
Most assuredly, Michael May from the Sendero Group was also there talking about GPS, but unlike most of the presentations that I've seen by him and others who deal with GPS, that is vendors of the product, he was talking about it in a much broader sense. He was looking at two or three big issues for GPS. One is a growing improvement in its accuracy. Secondly, a reducing in its price so that it is generally more broadly adopted by the community as a whole because they can afford it, or the agencies that provide them services can see themselves clear for purchasing it on behalf of their clients. And also he was concerned about two other things. He really did indicate, and he may disagree with this after the fact, but he sure did indicate clearly to me and the people sitting around me that he thought that the future of GPS is going to be going away from the PDA market and toward the wireless phone or mobile phone market. He said none of the products that are currently out there right now give you 100% access to what's there. Some of them get temptingly close, as I know you know, Paul, but there's these points in the process that are not accessible. So he was interested in that. And he was also interested in individuals who move from an outdoor environment where their receivers can pick up the satellite signals necessary to pull this all off, an indoor environment where that doesn't exist, and putting, if you will, a dual system together, one that would help you with orientation outdoors and another that would engage immediately as you passed indoors, taking advantage of such things as talking lights, where the ballast control mechanisms and fluorescent light fixtures are tagged with information that your same device would pick up once it sensed that you were passing indoors and into an area lighted with these fluorescent light fixtures. I thought that was quite interesting that he would be taking a look beyond simply adding more features to an existing product to literally seeing that product move from platform to platform and take on a dual personality.
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you are listening to Tuesday Topics. If you have comments about the show or a suggestion of a topic you would like to have discussed, send a message to TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. That's TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Once again, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
I suppose that it probably behooves us to say that an announcement was released by Code Factory, one of the companies that is engaged in creating accessible software for cell phones, that they plan to have available by the end of this year a GPS product which just happens to be being designed and built by Sendero, and that will be usable on a broad range of smartphones by the beginning of 2009. Interesting. The outdoor-indoor interface, Mr. Bryan, perhaps needs a little more explanation. GPS, because it works on satellites, will only work outdoors, and once you get under a roof, it won't work. So these lights would presumably have to get their information to something like a GPS-equipped mobile phone in a different way. Did he talk about what technology they were considering using?
Again, I'm talking lights. So in a talking lights setup, and talking lights is a trademarked term, but I want you to think of it in more general terms at this point. The people need to understand that vapor-based lights, like fluorescent lights, like mercury vapor lights, like neon lights, actually have a small device at one end called a ballast that turns power on and off to that light fixture very, very rapidly in a way that the human eye cannot detect that the light is actually going on and off. By controlling these ons and offs and making the periods of offs or on be longer or shorter, it's the same equivalent of sending ones and zeros. So you can take the ballast, put it in, replace the existing ballast with a new one for all of $50, and that one will cause the light to flicker in a way that a receiver would interpret that as having a unique number. It could compare that number with a database of all of these numbers kept available wirelessly through your wireless phone, and it would puzzle together where you are in order to receive that particular light number and send that information back to that cell phone. So again, all a cell phone needs to have in terms of adaption is some kind of light sensor that would sense the ambient light in the environment you're in order to capture that signal number and send it out to the database. Seems pretty logical to me, and it may be that it's done by way of a more of, if you will, a Bluetooth kind of process than one that is necessarily a conventional light probe-ish kind of approach.
Now, I would put a question out there, Bryan, on these kind of lights. If I participate in some mailing lists of primarily sighted people, and that's been the huge complaint about CFLs and other lights, is the flicker. And apparently, you know, there's less flicker now, but it still does exist. And apparently, and again, most of us, if we have light perception, it's limited at best, so we don't see it. But apparently these lights can be unpleasant to the sighted eye. And I'm thinking if you have, you know, more and less flicker, that this could cause a problem for them. And I'm not sure we want to go there either. I certainly don't wish to cause anybody else any undue hardship. That would be defeating the process.
I participated in some of the studies, David, and it's clear that the kind of change that they would do to the flicker rate is not perceptible to the human eye. It's almost as if in place of one flicker point, they do two flicker points in the same period of time, and they can register those differences. Why that matters to us, and this is one of the reasons why the ballast is more expensive, because it has to cycle twice or maybe even 10 times faster. But the very fact that it's flickering faster means that the flicker is less perceptible rather than more perceptible to the end user. Again, my friends in the industry indicate that in fact, the flicker that you're experiencing is as the result of two things. Bad bulbs, and that's not going to change unless they get a little less stingy with their dollars and buy a better quality bulb. And cheap ballasts, which again, we're replacing the ballast, so things could actually improve for the sighted person.
Okay, and regardless of the technology, whether we're using Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, what we're talking about are technologies that are actually pretty commonly included in cell phones. So we are presumably only requiring the addition of some kind of a light detector or some kind of device that would enable us to actually recognize that the ballast in the light was sending us valid information and to go look it up. The advantage of having this indoor information available on a series of lights, I assume, is that it could actually provide you with as much information about things like points of interest and that kind of stuff as could a GPS system. But presumably, that system would in fact have to be designed by someone. And that's been, I guess, one of the areas in general where both GPS and presumably this new potential indoor system, and we need to probably stress that at least right now it is pretty potential, would have to rely on someone. So who's supposed to create all these points of interest that tells us exactly where we are and what's on our left and what's on our right, both in terms of GPS and in terms of this indoor system, Mr. Brian?
Well, in terms of GPS, people have to understand that the purpose of being outdoors and being in the line of sight of multiple satellites is not because the satellites are sending this complicated, wonderful information. They're simply beaming a unique number. And by detecting the time it takes for that number to be beeped from the satellite to where you're standing, as compared to how long it takes for a number to come from a different satellite and be picked up by your receiver, they take that information, establish a latitude and longitude that you'd have to be standing in for those to get to you in that period of time, compare it to a database that's on your PDA, and speak that information. The same thing would be true for the talking lights scenario. That is, you'd have this unique number, but only a number, which would then have to be compared to a database, and then that data spoken to you. During the process of the install of the ballasts, a database entry is made indicating what is at the location of that particular light. And that's how at least the initial database would be created. But in both cases, as things change, I couldn't go down the street here now and tell you that one of the points of interest on my GPS is wrong. That business wasn't that business for the past 8 years. It's changed hands. It's got a different purpose. It went from being a restaurant to a bar to a bakery. And only the original restaurant's name is in my GPS database. So at some point, things have to be changed. When it's in a PDA, the software literally has to be sent out to you on a CD or in some fashion that you would then upload into your PDA. In the case of a talking lights scenario, I would think that the situation would be much better, because as the fixture was altered with this new ballast, a website URL and username and password can be given to the establishment there, and as they want to change the information that is coded with that particular unique number of the light fixture, you would receive different kinds of information. So they could put things on there like what the daily special is in a restaurant. They could put their store hours, changes in store hours, ads of one kind or another for products and services. So I actually think that there's more value and promise for the indoor database than there is for the GPS outdoor database.
There are standard things that are parts of POIs in databases, but a lot of POIs are now actually being created by users of GPS systems. Do you think that this user input is an issue that we ought to give much credence to? Is this something that is going to have some kind of impact on the way that we acquire information in terms of what's around us and where it is and where we are?
Yes, I do believe that what's called user-generated content, UGC, is going to be very important. For example, imagine you're a GPS user and you're walking down the street with your trusty cane and you come across a place that has construction. You could, given the right software and wireless conditions, be able to stop right there and key in for a moment, or maybe just hold down a talk key and record that this intersection is currently blocked with construction and indicate the time. The next time a person comes behind you through that same area, they might hear, in addition to the regular location information, a beep tone that indicates to them that there's additional user-generated content for this point of interest, be able to hit a second button and hear what that previous pedestrian said about that area. Studies doing that kind of user-generated content are already underway in Europe. I would think also the same scenario could hold true for indoor information as well as outdoor information. All of the things that are possible out there just amazes me. And I'm really tickled that the Sendero product has enabled individuals who own the product to register points of interest that aren't in the initial database and save those on the website to be shared by all users. Again, as with all kinds of information, user beware. But I still think there's a great deal to be gained by that kind of information and help keep down the cost of all of this.
I think that the other point that we might make about user-generated content is that the information that blind people want may be substantially different from the information that most sighted people are interested in. To give an example, a typical GPS system will provide information about where the entrances to a college are and where perhaps parking areas are. But for the most part, beyond that, it's not going to provide very much information. The issue from the point of view of the more traditional commercial GPS system is simply to get a person there. Once they get there, they can use signs and other local bits of information to get around those people who can see. But we who are blind and who are traversing a campus on foot would really be helped immensely if there were POIs that would identify buildings, if there were POIs that would pop up and tell us where we were as we're traveling along an entirely unfamiliar route. And it's this kind of user-generated content that's ending up getting saved on websites and is making GPS products so much more useful to people who are blind and visually impaired than they would be if we only had access to commercial software. There were other panelists, I think, Mr. Brian. Were there enough panelists that we could perhaps spend another whole program next week talking about some of the issues so that we could pause and see if other folks have some questions for you about what we've talked about so far?
That would be fine with me.
Brian, this is Dave McElroy again. I wonder if anybody on that panel discussed the orientation ability for the newly elderly blind. Now, those of us who are here on our, although we, you know, whatever our ages be, we've all pretty much grown up with this kind of knowledge, and we've grown up in the computer world, from DOS to Windows 3.1 to Windows 95 to Windows 98 to XP to PDAs to cell phones. We've all grown through this. But I'm thinking that it really is probably relatively difficult for somebody who has, you know, all of a sudden they're not driving anymore and they're stuck and they're trying to learn all this, and now what?
I do think that the issue of how people are being taught orientation and mobility skills is a huge, huge issue. I'm concerned that individuals that I've spoken with who are longtime O&M instructors and who have been quality instructors throughout their lives are falling behind in terms of using anything other than the means that they were taught when they were in university 20, 30, 40 years ago. Traffic situations are not the same as they were when they got their formal training in O&M. What resources are available to a blind or visually impaired person are not the same that they were back in the day. There are some advantages to today's universe with some of the technologies that we're talking about, most of which are not user-owned. Audible pedestrian signals are not owned by the user. They just have to be taught how to find the pole to push the button. Detectable warnings don't require a great deal of training to understand. You feel them underfoot, you stop. If you know where you're going from here, you proceed after appropriate caution is observed. while there are things like GPS and talking signs and the like, as much as possible, those are being designed to be as simple as possible. For recently, the Trekker has a baby cousin, so to speak, called Trekker Breeze. Many fewer buttons, many fewer decisions to be made. It simply tells you where you are, rather than setting up routes that you have to follow and much keyboarding to accomplish. Having to set up the receiver here and the transmitter there and the setting up the speech configuration, all that kind of stuff is eliminated in the Trekker Breeze. And again, once it converges onto the single item, the mobile phone, then probably things will become even simpler to use. So I'm not worried so much about that situation as I am about some of the technologies that are going to impact what makes a car, in the same way that we worried about the little scooter that was allowed on sidewalks. God, I can't remember the name of that thing right now. And how silent it was. As cars get quieter, whether or not they're the hybrids that work on electricity, they're certainly quieter than the cars I was taught O&M with. One of my biggest concerns about the O&M training, in addition to the need for existing trainers to get with it a little bit in terms of using these alternative and additional methods for orientation and mobility, is that we as end users have to take a little more responsibility for our O&M.
Brian, you didn't respond to Dave's question, and that is to what degree are newly blinded older people befuddled by the new systems?
Well, Gil Johnson was the moderator, and while I dearly love Gil, he's not a spring chicken. And in fact, although he uses technology personally in his office, he's kind of uncomfortable with it outside of the office. He's been doing cane travel for a long time, and while the universe has been changing around him, he hasn't found it to be a nice place to be moving around in. He's using more traditional technologies to assist him in getting around in his environment. Specifically, he uses a lot of RaceLine maps. And there are some new technologies that allow individuals and entities to generate maps of very specific areas, ones that may not be so popular. Maybe where you live, David, there's not a lot of tactile maps of the area. Well, now you can send your particular address to a website, and that website will generate a RaceLine map, and the San Francisco Lighthouse will send it on to you. So you can get a Braille map of just about any neighborhood. So I guess the answer is life is much more complicated. We have a combination of services such as fixed route bus systems and paratransit. We have a mixture of audible traffic signals and detectable warnings and indoor and outdoor talking signage. We have large print signage that has to live up to a particular standard and Braille signage that has to live up to a particular standard. And in combination of all of these different possibilities lives the everyday Joe. And the everyday Joe has some responsibility to learn how to use them most effectively, in the same way they have to learn to use the cane effectively. They have to learn to use these other tools. And hopefully they'll have access to qualified O&M instructors and interaction with fellow blind and visually impaired individuals that will assist them in making that transition.
Are there questions on the or comments on the issues that we've discussed this week that people would like to raise before we relatively soon draw this program to a close?
Yes, I hope this is not too far afield, but I was thinking, and you actually got me thinking when you were talking about the structured negotiations. And this leads to safety, this leads to roundabouts, and I hope it all ties in. We are having one blaze of a time with our city, which does not want to spend the money for any kind of audible signals. Now, we're also told that there are grants available and that we need to get hold of the city and say, you know, you guys really don't want to be against going against the law, so why don't you consider this, and here's the information. What can we do to get the city made aware that it, A, may not cost them an arm and a leg, which is their concern, and B, that we follow the access guidelines and, well, more than that, B, we're safe, and C, follow the law.
The American Council of the Blind has actually published a number of documents which are intended to provide assistance to communities like yours. I don't know how recently they've been updated. I would suggest they're probably a year or two old now, but they are available on the ACB website at www.acb.org. I think they're available in the section called Resources. There are essentially handbooks which take traffic engineers to the elements that they need to look at that directly not only tell them what they need to put in, but also talk a little bit about the laws, talk a little bit about various options that are out there in terms of various products that they can take a look at. Brian, would you like to add anything to that?
The only thing I'd add, and I do think that it's well worth adding to our agenda for next week, and that is that when you start to think about what it costs to create an intersection in terms of the underlayment of all of the public utilities that pass through that intersection, the cost of the paving itself, the sidewalks, the curbs, all of the painting, the signaling, etc., the cost of accessible signals is such a small, small fraction of that, that whenever an intersection's being dramatically upgraded, that is, they're putting in new signaling for general traffic purposes, then we ought to be right on top of it and get our cities and towns to agree, hey, I understand you don't have it today, but can you make a commitment that when you redo this signal, that at that time you will commit to, in writing, that that be an accessible intersection in terms of this. And in the interim, as time and money allows, grants like you were describing a moment ago are a good example of that, they will take full advantage of opportunities to fund these safe pedestrian intersections. It's not an easy thing to do. Just getting accessible signals in place does not end the advocacy needs. It's also keeping them properly maintained.
I think the one thing that's really apparent is that we have lots of issues for next week. So we hope that everyone will turn up for Musing on Mobility Part 2, where we will be exploring what makes a good O&M instructor, talking some more about accessible pedestrian signals and how they fit into the system, current approaches to getting them, the cycles of pedestrian signals in general, to what degree do traffic patterns make for good and bad accessible pedestrian signals. Are blind people actually traveling more or less than they used to? Are folks actually out there pounding the pavement with canes and guide dogs more than they did 10 or 15 years ago? These are just some of the questions that we still have to explore. And there's still another whole panelist as well, who Brian hasn't told us about. So we hope you'll be with us again next week, Brian Charlson, to act as the kind of leader of our discussion. I'd like to thank everyone for their input this evening, and I'd like to thank all of you for tuning in to Tuesday Topics. Remember, when you're trying to get around in your community, the best way to do it is to recognize that one of the ways is to keep in touch with Tuesday Topics, which you can do by sending an email to us at TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Let us hear from you, and we hope to see you next week.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 1 hour Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics Chat Room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. we'll look for you in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.